Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. Hoo-wah! I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. You know, we veterans took an oath to support and defend the Constitution. We live in a constitutional republic, not a democracy. Our founders worked hard to keep us from being a democracy where the majority can rule and the majority can vote to take your property away or make you a slave. No, our Constitution makes us a nation of laws, and those laws protect individuals from being abused by the majority. As important as our Constitution is, a recent survey shows that 57% of Americans have never read the Constitution. So when you're walking through your neighborhood, chances are good that in every house you pass, at least half the people who live there haven't read one of our most important documents. Worse, 26% cannot name a single right protected by the First Amendment. Not freedom of religion, not freedom of speech, not freedom of assembly, not a single one. So let me encourage you to get a copy of your Constitution and read it periodically and be sure your children develop this habit too. Okay, joining me at the 50 caliber microphone today is Marine vet Skip Coriel. Skip, what have you been doing lately?
Oh, Colonel, I've been doing all kinds of stuff. I've been putting up chicken fencing for my chickens, getting ready to plant. All kinds of things. I'm getting ready for spring, and you know, mushroom hunting season is coming up soon too.
Do you hunt them with a gun?
It's a low caliber hunt. Low caliber hunt.
Yeah. Okay, here's what we have for you today. On news and comments by the Colonel, I'm going to discuss the disaster that is our nation's higher education system. Then Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby will share his warrant wisdom. Next, retired General Eric Wesley we'll discuss Operation Thunder Run, the fight into the capital of Iraq on the 20th anniversary of that victory. Then Elaine Donnelly from the Center for Military Readiness will discuss the military's requirement of males using women's showers. And veteran Mike Irwin will share about Team Red, White, and Blue.
Hey, troops, please invite your friends to join us at this time on this great radio station. Then head on out to frontlinesoffreedom.com and sign up for our free e-newsletter. And join the conversation at facebook.com/frontlinesoffreedom.
We welcome your input to this show. Send us your ideas and comments through our website, frontlinesoffreedom.com, or do it on Facebook. And now it's time for news and comments by the Colonel on Frontlines of Freedom, and we'll start with the news, of course. Take us there, Skip.
The Department of Justice appears to have discouraged U.S. Marshals from arresting protesters illegally demonstrating at the homes of the Supreme Court justices, according to internal materials obtained by a U.S. senator. Republican Alabama Senator Katie Britt revealed training slides reportedly from a whistleblower in DOJ. Those slides were used to prepare U.S. Marshals for their protective details outside of justices' homes, according to the senator. Britt said that the DOJ explicitly discouraged marshals from enforcing the law against the protesters without coordination with the relevant U.S. Attorney's Office, warning that it could be counterproductive for the marshals to make arrests on cases that the DOJ will not charge and prosecute. Quote, not a single person has been prosecuted for illegally harassing Supreme Court justices outside of their homes, unquote, Britt said after the hearing. The reason is crystal clear. The Department of Justice has willfully chosen not to enforce federal law.
And this is the nation that we vets put our lives on the line to defend. We're supposed to be a nation of law that everybody obeys, not one with selective enforcement.
And a university professor in Michigan has been placed on leave after declaring it would be more admirable to kill guest speakers who hold transphobic, racist, and homophobic views than to just shout them down. Stephen Shaviro, who teaches film and media studies courses at Wayne State University, took to Facebook to express his thoughts about free speech on campus, claiming that he does not advocate violating federal and state criminal codes. Nevertheless, he wrote that right-wing speakers deserve death because they are precisely invited by right-wing college groups with the intention to provoke incidents that discredit the left and give more publicity and validation to the reprehensible views they allegedly have. Quote, protesters get blamed instead of the bigoted speaker. The university administration finds a perfect excuse to side publicly with the racist or phobes, and the international and national press has a field day saying that bigots are the ones being oppressed, Shaviro continued.
Somewhere I get the crazy idea that the purpose of colleges and speakers there is to get students to understand and consider the various sides of all issues and not to lead them to either shout down or kill speakers. This guy is clearly into indoctrination of students. This professor should be fired, if not charged for promoting violence. Gads.
A federal program intended to reduce American reliance on communist Chinese-produced computer chips is instead being used to coerce companies to adopt radical left-wing social policies. U.S. Senate Commerce Committee member Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas, and over a dozen other Senate Republicans have demanded Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo and President Biden to strike a number of left-wing social and political demands companies must agree to in order to receive funds from the $39 billion CHIPS Act, a bill enacted last year to boot U.S. semiconductor manufacturing. U.S. companies are ineligible for the program unless they agree to Green New Deal mandates, mandates for cradle-to-grave wraparound services for employees, subsidizing housing and transportation for employees, discrimination in hiring practices against non-union workers, and economically disadvantaged individuals and government seizure of excess profits, Cruz reports. The CHIPS Act was passed for the purpose of reversing the decline of the domestic semiconductor industry. It is apparent that the Commerce Department intends to repurpose the CHIPS program and circumvent Congress. We urge the department to reverse these superfluous and partisan provisions immediately, Cruz and senators write in a letter to Raimondo. Quote, many of the grant criteria detailed in your department's recent notice of funding opportunity will have the opposite effect of Congress's intent and instead make domestic chip production more expensive, less competitive, and reliant on taxpayer subsidies over private investment, unquote.
Bringing manufacturing, especially of key items like chips, back to our nation is vital. The government needs to support free enterprise and not try to force manufacturing companies into politically correct subjects not focused on being productive capitalist companies. What's going on here?
The military's top uniformed officer suggested he does not support drag shows being hosted on military bases, something that has been done for years to boost morale and show support for LGBTQ members of the military community, but which has come under attack by Republicans as part of their war on wokeness. During a House Armed Services Committee hearing, Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican from Florida, grilled Defense Secretary Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, on several recent drag events that have become extensively discussed in conservative media, including a planned drag queen story time that Ramstein Air Base, Germany, canceled last year after criticism. Quote, I'd like to take a look at those myself and find out what actually is going on there, because that's the first I'm hearing about that kind of stuff, Milley said, after Gaetz read several headlines from conservative outlets about the drag events. Quote, I'd like to take a look at those because I don't agree with those. I think those things shouldn't be happening, unquote. Drag events on military bases are often sponsored by private groups. Drag queen story hours is not something that the department funds, Austin repeated several times when asked about the events.
Let's see. This has been going on for years, and General Milley is just now hearing about them? Sorry, I don't buy that. He's either dumb or lying. And I don't care what adults do on their own time, but I do care about indoctrinating children with things like drag queen story time that was canceled before it could happen in Germany. That's wrong. We need to stop promoting this stuff. And that's the news. As Americans, it's our responsibility to ensure that our nation is well-run and on the right path. Politics and politicians are confusing, but we can work together. Concerned Veterans for America can assist you, even if you're not a vet, in getting involved in getting our nation back on track. Working with them is one of the things I do. Check CV4A.org. That's CV4A.org. This is Colonel Danny Gillum. Coming up on Front Lines of Freedom, I'll share comments by the Colonel and we'll enjoy some warrant wisdom. Then we'll review Operation Thunder Run with General Eric Wesley. At ease, troops, take a break.
This is Lieutenant Colonel retired John Barry, managing partner of Barry Law. For over 50 years, Barry Law has defended the rights of Americans, both on the battlefield and in the courtroom. We are committed to supporting our fellow service members. If you need help appealing your VA disability decision, find us at PTSDlawyers.com or call 888-883-2483.
This is Marine Vet Skip Coria with your home defense tip of the week. Most home invasions occur when people are at work between the hours of 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. Because of this, we highly recommend the installation of a home security video surveillance system. These systems are easy to install and cost only a few hundred dollars. They allow you to monitor your home while you're at work via your computer or cell phone. This is just one more way to keep your family safe. For more useful tips on home and personal defense, visit HomeDefenseShow.com.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. It's 20 minutes after the hour, and you're in formation and listening to the Front Lines of Freedom all across America. Now it's time for comments by the Colonel. Colleges and universities in our nation are in trouble. It's from these institutions that we get most of our military officers and many enlisted members. The big schools are flunking Business 101. They're facing declining enrollment and growing opposition to the rising tuition rates and the woke nonsense being pushed on students. Undergraduate enrollment dropped by 650,000 students last year. Over the last decade, it's dropped 14%. This is as our population continues to increase by over 1 million annually. Victor Davis Hanson, a Hoover Institution and Stanford prof, specifically blasted privileged colleges as, quote, overpriced indoctrination echo chambers, end quote. Hey, I have a master's degree from Stanford in education administration. I earned it while I was a part of the Army ROTC faculty while we were being thrown off campus. Oops, I mean phased out in protest of the Vietnam War. This was in the early 1970s. Stanford was really liberal then, but there was real education and learning taking place there. You know, back in those days, all the instructors at West Point were active duty Army officers, and these officers were sent to good schools like Stanford to prepare for their teaching role. But that's in the past. Now, these colleges are beyond woke. Stanford recently pledged to eliminate harmful online language, including horribly offensive words such as American and survivor and walk-in hours and immigrant. Oh, and the words stupid and crazy aren't permitted either. They've published quite a list of bad words, but that list is for internal use only. If you're curious, the problem with the word American is that it's often used to refer to residents of the United States, implying that people from Canada, Mexico, or Central or South America are somehow inferior or less American. The solution that they offer is to use U.S. citizen instead. And the problem with a store posting walk-in hours is that it unfairly favors the ambulatory. Conservative economist Stephen Moore noted that, quote, kids are graduating from college after spending $100,000 or more, and they're graduating without useful skills or talents. That's one of the first complaints you hear from employers, end quote. Well, here are some of the most notable trends. Over the past year, college and university enrollment suddenly dropped 4%. Enrollment among male students, apt to be targeted on campus for toxic masculinity, has declined the most. There's 71% of the decline. History and English profs have become an endangered species on campus, with majors in those areas dropping by half on many campuses. The number of tenured professor slots in those disciplines has declined by 30 to 53%, and many of the ones remaining are focused on lecturing students about such nonsense topics as social justice, critical race theory, and inclusion. And all this occurred while the number of administrative, non-teaching roles on campuses has skyrocketed. Example, at Yale, administrative positions increased over 150% in the past two decades, while the number of profs has dropped by 19%. Stanford recently enrolled nearly 17,000 undergrad and grad students, but lists nearly 16,000 administrative staff members, about one admin person per student. Boy, that makes sense. Not. This looks like a racket to me, especially as grads are not coming out with useful talents or skills. How does this help our nation or our economy? The growing concerns over the real-world value of awarding a diploma on one hand and a massive loan obligation on the other comes as major U.S. firms appear increasingly open to filling important positions with people who have no college degree. Google, IBM, and Delta Airlines are among the major U.S. employers who have largely dropped the expectation that new employees will have a diploma. Oh, the technical and vocational market's doing well. It's expected to grow at a rate of 8.5%. Indeed, while I was teaching college, I encouraged all college-age youth to consider learning a trade first and to pick up some college later if they wanted to. Of course, this didn't apply to those looking to become doctors or lawyers or engineers. Again, quoting Victor Davis Hanson, quote, left-wing indoctrination, administrative bloat, obsessions with racial preferences, arcane jargon-filled research, and campus-wide intolerance of diverse thought have shortchanged students, further alienated the public, and often enraged alumni. It's a terrible thing for an educational institution to have only one way of thinking on any subject. Having open, honest discussion on hot topics is critical in business and the real world, and where else would this be taught and experienced if not in college? When the only way to see the world on a given topic is the woke way, then real thinking is not only not being encouraged, it's being damned. This is the same kind of nonsense that was fed to us during the COVID crisis, where we were told what the science said, and doctors could lose their licenses if they spoke or felt otherwise. And the way the climate change crowd claims that they have fixed science on their topic, so it's not debatable. Anyone who knows anything about science knows that there is no fixed science, that everything can be challenged and debated. Do remember that science once said the world was flat? So, how many military officers do we want with this kind of education? Based on my 22 years of active duty as an airborne ranger infantryman, I'd say zero. So, how do we get educated officers who've been educated to think, analyze, and evaluate logically? And those are my comments for today. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. You're listening to Frontlines of Freedom, and now we get to enjoy some warrant wisdom with Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. What do you have to share this week, Roland?
So who doesn't like a good air show? You know, last week I had the opportunity to go to Sun and Fun down in Lakeland, Florida. They call that the spring break for pilots, believe it or not. I flew down with my good friend and prior Frontlines of Freedom co-host, Lieutenant Colonel Steve Kenyon. We had the opportunity to do a little camping at the aircraft and talk with many veterans and watch some amazing aircraft perform. The military was out in full force with a number of static displays, including the older-than-me KC-135, the C-17, which I've flown in a number of times to Iraq and Afghanistan, and then the just plain huge C-5 Galaxy. This was the first time I'd actually seen the C-5 firsthand, and you just can't believe how big it actually is. For the afternoon air shows, they had both the Air Force F-35 Alphas and the Marines F-35 Bravo demo teams. And of course, the Blue Angels finished off the afternoon with what is always a spectacular show. You know, I spoke with the Blue Angels 2 years ago at Sun and Fun, where they were doing their very first show with the new F-18 Super Hornets. It was even better this year. A unique aspect of Sun and Fun is the evening air shows on Wednesdays and Thursdays. There's just something spectacular about fast military jets and World War II aircraft performing at sunset. And once it gets dark, there are a number of aircraft performing with fireworks shooting right off their wings. It's a magical show, which ends with one of the best fireworks displays I've ever seen. Now, where these shows really shine to me is after it's all done and over with and the people have all gone home, except for those who are camping on the airfield with our aircraft or the airshow performers. And this is when we get a chance to talk with these amazing performers and military members. It is just phenomenal conversations. I encourage you, just go and see an air show. See what some of these amazing military aircraft can do. My personal favorite, the F-22. You know, airplanes are just not supposed to fly like that. They're just so cool. For Frontlines of Freedom, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. Back to you, Colonel.
Straight ahead on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll discuss Operation Thunder Run with General Eric Wesley. Then we'll talk about our woke military with Elaine Donnelly from the Center for Military Readiness. All this is coming up. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. You're standing tall with the Frontlines of Freedom. I'll be right back. Troops, it's time for sit-ups. Start with 50, take a break and do another 50. Then stand at ease. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code.
From ending our nation's endless wars, to making sure veterans get the care they deserve, to addressing our country's out-of-control spending problem, Concerned Veterans for America is taking on the most important issues facing our nation. You can help CVA shape a better future for Americans everywhere. Visit cv4a.org to learn more, see how you can get involved, and join our movement. That's cv4a.org.
Troops, welcome back to our nation's largest military veteran talk radio show, Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Troops, please do send me your comments and questions. Email me through frontlinesoffreedom.com. It's an honor to welcome back retired Army General Eric Wesley. We discussed his company, Parasanti, last time. This time, we're going to discuss one of the most amazing attacks our Army has made in a long, long time. It was called Thunder Run. So, welcome back, Eric. Glad you could join us.
Thanks, Denny. It's good to be with you again. Thanks for having me.
Eric, let's start by reviewing your military career. Give us an overview of when you joined, why you joined. Take us quickly through your career so we get some idea of what you did.
Yeah, thank you. I grew up in California, Denny, and this is in the late 70s, early 80s when I graduated or went through high school. And this is a time when there was, you could call it morale problems in the United States, the era of malaise, I think, as President Carter called it. And I was a patriotic young kid, call myself a Reagan baby, and I was inspired to go to West Point. Graduated from West Point in 1986, and I became an armor officer with tanks, essentially, as a commander with the Abrams tank. And went to Ranger School and the Armor Basic, and then found myself in Germany, where I was a platoon leader and a scout platoon leader during the era of the Cold War, before the wall fell. In fact, while I was there is when things started to collapse in the late 80s for the Eastern threat that we were facing. Came back from Germany, and I commanded a company in the Big Red One, the 1st Infantry Division at Fort Riley, Kansas. Later, when I was promoted to major, I went to Fort Stewart, Georgia, and that's the home of the 3rd Infantry Division, Rock of the Marne. And during that tour is when OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom, would happen. We could talk more about that later. I later became a battalion commander of a tank battalion, 113 tank, and then also a brigade commander. Later commanded Fort Benning as a 2-star general. And then the latter part of my career, when I got promoted to 3-star, I was responsible for developing the future Army that we are modernizing to this day.
Okay, that's great. So when our challenge in Kuwait with Iraq began, you were a lieutenant colonel, as I recollect. Talk to us about where you were and what was going on prior to that led up to the move into Iraq.
Yeah, your listeners will recall that in 2001, obviously, we had the towers come down. It was a major event. And the original focus subsequent to September 11th was to go after the Taliban and those that enabled Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. But not long after that, as everybody will recall, the administration at the time had their eyeballs on Saddam Hussein and Iraq. And so there was this feeling at the time that there had to be a regime change in Iraq. Since the first Gulf War in the early 90s, there had always been a rotational brigade in Kuwait to provide deterrence against any potential second attack into Kuwait. And as we got closer to OIF-1, it was apparent that the administration was going to conduct a regime change there. And so we deployed to Kuwait as one of these rotational brigades to provide that deterrence in September of 2002. So between September 2002 and March 20th, when the war in Iraq kicked off, our brigade was primarily the sole brigade that was there for about 8 months straight, training in the Kuwaiti desert to prepare for that potential eventuality. So we had a good amount of time from September 11th and then when we went to Kuwait, time to anticipate what might this war look like to change the regime of Saddam Hussein eventually in 2003.
Okay, so you guys were there. And the stuff hit the fan. You were reinforced with the rest of your division. Talk about that. What happened when the president said go?
Well, yeah, that's an important point. So we were the only brigade there initially, but as it was apparent that the Congress had given authority to President Bush to conduct operations as he saw fit, we saw the arrival of the rest of the division, as you note, and then the Marine Division came in. So suddenly Kuwait became a very busy place, bringing in these remaining troops. On March 20th of 2003, we had actually anticipated a kickoff of the war of the 21st or the 22nd, but there was an acceleration that the administration directed. So very rapidly, we were told, hey, we're going to go on the 20th. And this is something, again, that we had prepared for months and months and envisioned in our mind, which is an important point. And it turns out, as we went over the border from Kuwait into Iraq, that 3rd Infantry Division, the Marne Division, with the Spartan Brigade, which I was in, conducted the fastest, longest armor attack in history. It was incredibly effective. And one of the takeaways I'd ask you to consider is this idea of the capacity of our soldiers. There's a lot of debate about OIF-1, but in terms of what the soldiers were able to conduct in that massive strike from the Kuwaiti border all the way up to Baghdad was impressive.
I think impressive is an understatement. We really put the pressure on them. And it wasn't just, can you do it? It's being shot at, sometimes quite effectively, while doing it. But they sure did it, didn't they? Actually, I should say you guys sure did it, didn't you?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I've said many times is the environment that we went through changed throughout the entire attack. You know, when you start in the Kuwaiti desert, it's as flat as a pool table. And we migrated north and the terrain changes. And our soldiers fought through agrarian and urban environments. They fought regulars and irregular opponents. They fought through farmlands. They fought through wadis in the desert, all different environments. And in every case, the soldiers were able to adjust their tactics, adjust their use of force, and adapt to whatever environment that they were in. It was very impressive.
You know, that has been throughout history something that American soldiers have been able to do. And I think it's because of both the culture and good leadership. Do you agree?
I do. One of the things that distinguishes our soldiers is that they're empowered. There's a trust between soldiers, NCOs, and officers, and we enable the NCO leadership to empower soldiers to make decisions. So they're used to doing that. We're seeing an alternative approach by the Russians in Ukraine now. And you can tell that, in fact, there are indicators that I think that President Putin wanted to attempt some of the same tactics that we did. But you can't try this at home unless you've got soldiers that are empowered, they're well-educated and well-trained. And so I think that they were able to demonstrate that during this campaign.
Yes, sir. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're discussing Operation Thunder Run with General Eric Wesley. Yeah, the Russians have never delegated authority down to their NCOs. Even junior officers don't have authority. So when you try to do it with no background, it doesn't work. But we do that.
We do. And the doctrine we use is mission command. And mission command talks about the leaders understanding the environment they're in, envisioning how they're going to see the battle play out, describing that to their soldiers, and then empowering and directing them. So as you know, as soon as the first shot's fired, the enemy has a vote and things don't go the way you expect them to. But you want your soldiers to understand and be empowered to make decisions, to adapt. And that's exactly what they did.
Well, God love them. And, you know, we're blessed to have been a part of that. Wow. Okay. So Thunder Run is something that happened as you guys were getting ready to go in and starting to go in. What guidance did you have? What guidance did you get from above? What did you give to your troops?
Well, so after we crossed the border, we moved very fast. At the time we were preparing for the assault into Baghdad, there was a brigade on the west side of Baghdad at the airport, and we were on the south side of Baghdad at the airport. The Marines were still progressing to our east. And the guidance that came from the commanding general, General Blunt, at the time was, as we were staged starting to surround the city, is to understand how well had they defended the city? What kind of defenses had they put in? The Presidential Guard was obviously the final barrier that protected Saddam's regime there in Baghdad, but we didn't have a good idea of what their defenses looked like. So General Blunt said, hey, I want 2nd Brigade, 3ID, the Spartan Brigade, to conduct an attack north on the highway, Highway 8 specifically. It looks just like a conventional freeway, frankly. It's a 4-lane highway with a guardrail in the middle, just like you might see in a United States freeway somewhere. It goes north directly to the center of Baghdad, and it doglegs west or left to the Baghdad airport. And he said, I want you to take one battalion and just conduct a thunder run. It's aptly named. It comes from the era of Vietnam. It was a way to use armored vehicles to penetrate areas where there might be ambushes or mines. And in Vietnam, it was intended to get supplies towards thunder outposts, which are artillery outposts. But he said, let's conduct a run into Baghdad, right up the center. And it was really a recon by fire to see what kind of defenses did they have. So 164 Armor was the battalion that was selected. The brigade commander, Colonel Perkins, now General Perkins, led that attack and drove right in on the 5th of April and ran directly north, dogleg left, and into the airport where they linked up with the other brigade.
More to discuss about Thunder Run, and General Wesley's going to stay with us. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Front Lines of Freedom. Yes, it's push-up time. I want you to do 103 push-ups. That's how many I do most days. Then take a break, but stay in the area. General Wesley and I will be right back.
This hour of Front Lines of Freedom is brought to you by HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net is an online resource and information center dedicated to the welfare of those who have sacrificed for the freedoms, ideals, and morals we Americans hold dear to our hearts. At HelpVet.net, find information on benefit-related issues from education, healthcare, military pay, retirement, VA loans, and resources on education, finance, legal, health and wellness, the military life, moving and housing, travel and entertainment, and much, much more. Visit HelpVet.net, HelpVet.net.
Fresh, flash, frozen. From the American farmer every time. PatriotFoods.com, hit the shop now button. You're supporting a veteran family in need every time you shop. Look at us online, see how we give back. For the servicemen and women of this great country, we are fighting for the American farmer. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM, 10% off today, folks. Shop now.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. I buy Patriot Foods. It's great. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Front Lines of Freedom. This is the final formation for this hour. We're continuing our conversation with General Eric Wesley about Thunder Run that took place 20 years ago as our troops took over Baghdad, Iraq. Okay, General, as we were talking before, one battalion from your brigade was going to run in and do a Thunder Run. Okay, so did they do it?
So the morning of the 5th of April, 2003, 164 Armor conducted an attack north on Highway 8, as I described. And, you know, this is something that we don't often train for. That is urban environments or urban attacks. They're very difficult. But the battalion proceeded north. It proceeded on track. But one of the first things we found was their defenses that they established were pretty much solidified around overpasses or cloverleaf intersections. All of us are familiar with going down the freeway and there may be an overpass and a cloverleaf complex. Well, that became their strong points that they defended from. And so this is an important point because, as I said earlier, as we moved north from Kuwait, we were learning the entire time because we were going through different environments. Now we're in a city with 6 million people penetrating north on a four-lane highway. And where their major defenses were at these overpasses or cloverleaf intersections. You can imagine if you're in a tank or a Bradley fighting vehicle and you're fighting north, you've got a main gun weapon system, plenty of firepower, but it's a whole different thing if somebody's shooting down at you from an overpass. So those became fundamental. The volume of fire that the battalion experienced was stunning in many ways. And the idea was just to use shock and awe to penetrate that while we're learning about these defenses. But what we found was RPGs, heavy weapon systems, machine guns, these kinds of things were all being used, oriented on this column that was going north. At the time, we lost one tank because of a lucky shot that penetrated the engine, started to catch fire, and the column was paused. And they had to try to put that fire out. Ultimately, we found that it hit the fuel cell. So every time they put the fire out, it would start up again. So we evacuated that tank and left the tank on the highway and proceeded up Highway 8, dogleg left, and found ourselves then arriving at the airport where we linked up with our sister brigade. So that first day was pretty significant. And we learned a lot. And at the end of that, the battalion came back to the brigade area, back south of Baghdad, to consider what was next.
Okay. I can't wait. Tell us what was next.
Well, you know, it's interesting because one of the things General Perkins at the time determined was that although there was a lot of firepower oriented at that battalion, that our brigades were so well trained, there was nothing that was going to stop that formation going through with the amount of firepower we had. So in consultation with General Blunt, the decision was to conduct a second Thunder Run a day and a half later on the 7th of April. And the idea this time is rather than just take one battalion, we would take all three maneuver battalions into Baghdad. And the other thing was we wouldn't leave, that we were going to go up Highway 8, and then right where Highway 8 doglegs to the left along the Tigris River, they're going to bear right and go right to the center of the government that was in power at the time, right to the government ministries, and put tanks into those buildings and on the grounds of the palaces. One of the things General Perkins had said in December of 2002, he says, you know, he said that the Iraqi people have never seen a foreign tank in downtown Baghdad. All we have to do is put tanks on the steps of the palace, and that place is going to collapse. That's what the 7th of April was for. And so General Perkins and my staff, we put together a plan to take the entire brigade, go to the downtown district, and stay. And if we could stay, we knew that there would be a collapse.
Well, you did go in, you did make the Thunder Run, and you did stay. How did it feel?
Well, so on the 7th, right around 5:30 in the morning, we kicked off the attack. And this time, again, all three battalions this time, and the intent was to stay. And the night before, I will tell you that we found, based on UAV feeds, after we put out the operations order, that they were starting to put lots of obstacles up Highway 8. So we knew that it wasn't going to be as easy. And I remember saying to General Perkins or Colonel Perkins at the time, you know, what are the conditions that would require you would withdraw? And he said, we're going to Baghdad. And I said, sure, I got it. And I said, but what would be the conditions for you to withdraw from Baghdad if this doesn't work? And he said two things. One is if our resupply convoys get ambushed or destroyed. The second thing is if we lose your command post and we don't have command and control because we're going to have 5,000 soldiers in a downtown area of 6 million people. So we LD'd, we departed at 5:30 in the morning. It was all going to plan. And I remember at about 10:30 in the morning when all the battalions had seized their objectives in the downtown area, I picked up a satellite phone, stepped out of the command post and called Colonel Perkins to congratulate him. If I could tell you, interestingly, at that moment, when I was talking to him on the phone, the command post got hit by a massive missile, probably an Ababil or Frog missile, that literally incinerated the command post. So what was a good day starting out by about 10:30, all objectives seized, then things got a little bit difficult.
Yeah, it sounds like you should have bought a lottery ticket. You took the right time to go outside and make a phone call.
Well, actually, the missile ended up, I walked out of the command post, went to my Humvee, grabbed the satellite phone and dialed him up and started wandering around as one does on the cell phone outside. Turns out the missile went right through the truck that I had just pulled that satellite phone out of. It destroyed about 29 vehicles, 23 soldiers were wounded, there was 5 killed, and the place was just on fire. I was fortunate, to your point, threw me to the ground, but was not wounded. But now we've got chaos in the command post.
Chaos, I believe. Eric, we've got a couple of minutes left. Wrap this baby up. How did it all come out?
Well, I share that story because it was one of the conditions that would withdraw him from Baghdad. The other thing that happened later in the day is the convoy of logistics was ambushed. But the instincts of the brigade commander was, in spite of those conditions, I think we can stay in Baghdad. And we did that. We were able to put the command post back together, and we were able to get resupply to the tanks and Bradleys inside the city. And within 24 hours, the government collapsed. The story ensues, and we had an insurgency that followed. But the takeaway was this operation, one of the most complex, fast, longest armored attack in history, was conducted by amazing soldiers who had incredible talents. And this, now that we're at the anniversary, we're celebrating their talents. We're celebrating their skills. We can debate the policy, but the United States knows and can know they've got some amazing soldiers that conduct amazing operations.
Well said, Eric. There's good and bad parts of everything, and nothing is ever done perfectly. But boy, do we have, and we certainly did have then, good soldiers, were motivated to the right thing, well-trained, and willing to step up and step into the gap and make things happen. If we don't do anything else today, we have to salute the soldiers that did that.
That's absolutely right. And I hope on this weekend, after this anniversary, that we would just appreciate the capacity of the American soldier. They were phenomenal that week. And one other point I would tell you is what they accomplished was overshadowed in many ways by the insurgency. For right reason, we needed to pursue that. But that was an amazing campaign by an amazing formation.
Well said. And I'm just delighted that we could take this time to celebrate that incredible action, the soldiers that did it. Just job well done. Everybody needs to stand up and be proud of this. Wow. Eric, thank you. Any final thought? Mission accomplished for my goal of honoring this event.
It's been a blessing to be with you, Denny. I appreciate you telling stories about American soldiers. Keep that narrative up, because they're selfless servants. They don't ask for much, and they do great work.
Well, thank you, Eric, for joining us today, and thank you for your service to our nation. I'm proud to call you a friend.
Likewise, Denny. Have a good day.
This concludes the first hour of the show. We'll start the second hour talking with Elaine Donnelly from the Center for Military Readiness about sex changes. Then veteran Mike Irwin will share about Team Red, White, and Blue. Of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag, military history, and our self-defense report. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for pull-ups. Do 30 good ones, then grab some protein, rehydrate with water, and finally, put a big smile on your proud-to-be-an-American face and send me your thoughts by email or on Facebook.